This is Veronica Entwistle saying welcome to Paradigm Shifters, and our Paradigm Shifter today is Matthew Fox, who's bringing forward some of the deepening, I guess we'll say deepening ecumenical wisdom from Meister Eckhart from the 12th and 13th century. And Matthew Fox, once a Dominican priest, but actually seems quite proud of having been doffed of your cloth, I think, I would say, and moved on to being an Episcopalian priest, but is making huge, huge inroads in people's spiritual consciousness to help empower our species. So that was a long preamble, but welcome so much to our show Paradigm Shifters, Matthew Fox.
Thank you, Veronica. I like the name of your show.
Well, you're certainly one of those, aren't you?
Well, I've been called a lot worse things, so I'm open to that.
You know, when you were talking about your history and how you've run up against some of the rule-bound, like the dogmas, the religious groups, the political groups, and so on, I'm really proud of your having had the courage. I'm just really, really honored and impressed and inspired by your courage to just move through those changes and take the rap or the names that they're calling you or whatever in order to be of a purer nature, I would say.
Well, thank you. I have always admired courage, and I look forward in others so that I can learn it. But sometimes circumstances just force you to take a stand, and I did stand up to Cardinal Ratzinger and the Vatican for a number of decades because I thought they were talking nonsense about women and about gay people and weren't talking at all about important things like ecology and the sacredness of creation and the wisdom traditions of the Bible and the importance of world ecumenism, of interfaith spirituality.
What did you call it? Ecumenism?
Ecumenism, yeah. Deep ecumenism or interfaith.
I remember the big ecumenical movement when I was a Catholic student years ago. It was a big movement, wasn't it?
Right, absolutely. And, of course, liberation theology in Latin America, which those two popes purposefully destroyed. One missionary priest I talked to recently says he thinks Pope John Paul II murdered 10,000 people in Latin America.
Wow.
Because of their stand against liberation theology in base communities. It got a lot of people killed. And
talk about the Crusades, huh?
Well, exactly. But anyway, this new pope is different.
Thank heavens. Yeah, he seems like he's got a lot of possibility, but the political machine being what it is, we're all kind of going, okay.
Yeah, really, good luck. Good luck with that.
Well, he needs all the prayers he can get. But
your latest
book, before we go too far in, I wanted to mention the name of your latest book called Meister Eckhart, A Mystic Warrior for Our Times. Not warrior, warrior, right?
Exactly, yeah, very different.
Uh-huh. And the mystic... Well, I'll let you talk about it, but one of the things I really, really have loved so far in this book is the depth. When you call it ecumen, is that what you call it?
Ecumenism.
But, yeah, and that's the depth of the the common threads of beingness that run through every religion, every political thing.
Exactly.
If we allow it. How did you get into all this anyway? How did you get into Meister Eckhart from being a Dominican priest?
Well, Eckhart was a Dominican, although he was condemned by the Pope in his day, a week after he died in the early 14th century.
Wow.
And he followed right on Thomas Aquinas, who was a Dominican brother of his. He was 17 years old when Aquinas died. And he was 13 years old when Rumi died.
Oh, really?
So he was very much a part of that era of great mysticism and science, really. They were very interested, Aquinas certainly was, in cosmology and how nature worked. Aquinas, of course, borrowed from Aristotle, who was the best scientist that medieval ages came up with. And all that inspired Eckhart very much. But in all my training, 14 years training as a Dominican, I never heard Eckhart's name used once because he was condemned. But I really found him through Kumaraswamy, the Hindu writer who wrote a great book on nature and art in the 1930s. He wrote it, and his old chapter on Eckhart. And I quote from that chapter in this book. And Kumaraswamy says that reading Eckhart is like reading the Upanishads, and that his words often sound like a straight translation from the Sanskrit, he says. Mm-hmm. Well, that's tremendous praise coming from a Hindu. Kumaraswamy was a Hindu. And that's what's so amazing about Eckhart. As you said, he goes so deep into his own soul and his own tradition that he joins the what I call the underground river of common wisdom. And my book, I think, this new book on Eckhart, this is my third book on Eckhart. I wrote two books previously, but over 30 years ago. And I've taught probably thousands of students Eckhart over the years, and I've seen the tremendous impact he has on people's lives. But
well, let me interrupt you just for a sec, that I'm a long-term student of metaphysics and haven't read it. But reading this book, I'm going, my life is changing as I read it.
Oh, how exciting.
Yeah.
Glad to hear that.
Well, I'm also a mystic, you know, and he talks,
right? Well,
you talk, and he talks a lot about that deep
sure.
value, you know, in a way I haven't
Absolutely.
Thought about it.
I mean, he's one of the greatest of the Westerners, and we hardly know him again because he was condemned. And that's why he's, I think he's really, this is his time. His time has come. I think the 21st century, we can begin to grasp the depth of what he's about. And the ecumenism, the interfaith, because, as you know from seeing the table of contents of the book, I put him in the room with Rabbi Heschel, a great Jewish theologian, put him in the room with Kumaraswamy and Father Bede Griffiths, two experts at Hinduism, put him in the room with Thich Nhat Hanh, because he's very Buddhist. The great Japanese Buddhist philosopher Suzuki told Thomas Merton that Meister Eckhart was the one Zen thinker of the West, and that he should read Eckhart. And the result was that Merton was converted in the year 1960. He spent reading just Eckhart and Zen poetry, and he entirely shifted, and he became a much more prophetic voice in the 1960s. And then he died at the end of the decade in the East, where he was traveling, and he kept a journal, and in the margins he would write, Eckhart is my lifeboat, Eckhart is my lifeboat. So Eckhart was hugely important to Thomas Merton. He was important to Suzuki and to Kumaraswamy, I say, who said he was, it's like reading the Upanishads. And indigenous wisdom, too. I put him in the room with Black Elk and a chapter on shamanism because he has a lot in common with the indigenous tradition as well. And of course, Carl Jung says that he owes Eckhart. Eckhart gave him the key to the unconscious. And Jung quotes Eckhart over 30 times, and he wrote a whole essay on Eckhart and the relativity of God. And he says that of all Christian thinkers, Eckhart was the one who gave him life when he read him. So Eckhart's influence has been immense.
But I think what happens, at least for me, when I was reading it, we need to get into the women's part too.
Yeah, definitely.
His thing about isness and dropping through all the God labels that we've gotten into, all of that just means so much. It's so empowering to read into that.
I'm glad. I'm so glad you got that from him. Yeah, his wonderful line, I pray God to rid me of God. I think a lot of people have prayed that sentence consciously or unconsciously over the centuries. And it opens the door to letting go and letting be. And as you say, isness, he says, isness is God. So that talks about the radical presence of the divine in all of being. And what he would call the cosmic Christ and what the Buddhists would call the Buddha nature that is present in all things.
It's very, 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 very touching. Also, when I was reading, the names are new to me, so forgive me that I don't quite remember the names, but there's a woman here, Adrienne Rich.
Oh, yes.
And one of the things that intrigued me, and I think it was weaving through all of them, actually, but hers was the most poignant as far as bringing it up, which is if you want to get into your spiritual and into the essence of the isness, I guess, you go through, and it was said in more than one place, but you go through things like grief, right? And loss.
Yes.
And one of them you said, and go to jail.
Well, definitely. That's what the mystics call the via negativa, the dark night of the soul. And Eckhart says, if you want the kernel, you must break the shell. So there is and he talks about breakthrough. In fact, he invented the word breakthrough in German, Durchbruch.
Oh, really?
And he says, in breakthrough, I learned that God and I are one. So there is breakdown, there's breakthrough. And Adrienne Rich, now, she's really important in the chapter on Eckhart and the Divine Feminine, because she was a wonderful feminist poet who wrote in the 70s and 80s. And I really use her a lot in that chapter because she's so profound. And she also wrote an important book, a prose book, called Of Women Born. Okay. And it's all about creativity. And she talks about the goddess as being the archetype of motherhood, really, of mothering and creativity. And, of course, Eckhart is extremely big on creativity, too. He says, what dost thou do all day long? God lies on a maternity bed giving birth.
I love that. What an image, eh?
What an image.
Well, that really makes you think. You sit there and think about that.
Yeah,
wow.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's about the intrinsic creativity of the universe. It's very much backed up by postmodern science. You see that a new star is being born every 15 seconds, for example. Mm. And all the birthing that's going on of galaxies and supernovas and planets and the universe. So anyway, Adrienne Rich, though, I just think is so, so rich in her naming of the feminist tradition. And so I put her in the room with that card, and I think they really make sparks together, because they both talk a lot about the role of sinking and letting go. And
it's the sinking in that she talked about in a way that really hit me.
Having experienced it,
but the value she gives it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Eckhart uses similar language. And they also talk about the darkness and the nothingness. And then I also have a chapter on Eckhart and the Beguine movement of his day, which is the women's movement in the Middle Ages. And the Beguines were neither nuns who were cloistered nor married, but they were single women who lived together in a community, but without the formal vows. And they worked with the poor and the young and the sick. And they were artisans. Many of them made their living as weavers and stained glass window makers and so forth. And but he was very influenced, Eckhart was, by the Beguines, and they by him. And Dorothy Sola, who died recently, but she was a liberation theologian, she loved Eckhart, and she said the mystics really deconstruct patriarchy because they get us not to think in terms of hierarchy, but in terms of a circle, a web of life, a web of existence. And that's a whole nother way of envisioning our presence on the planet. And
I want just for everybody who's listening, some of you haven't heard the name the Beguines, and it's Beguines. And Matthew, didn't you write that they went on for like two centuries?
Oh yeah, they were very viable for many centuries. The same Pope who condemned Eckhart a week after he died, condemned the Beguines 17 different times. So clearly it wasn't sticking, that condemnation.
Well, all publicity is good, right? Even if
it's there you go. Even then, and hundreds of thousands of them were very alive when he died. So they were especially big in the Netherlands and in Belgium.
And they also came from poor homes and so on, didn't they? I mean, they didn't.
Yeah, that's right.
They were not la crème de la crème or anything.
That's right. That's true. Mm-hmm. But one thing they did is they got themselves educated by hanging out with people like Meister Eckhart. They would attend his lectures. They actually, it's thanks to them that we have his sermons. They actually recorded them for us. By recorded, of course, I don't mean on a recorder. I mean they wrote them down for us.
I know that sort of shook me because they said they memorized them, and I went, "Oh boy, I bet you they were good at that in those days, eh?"
Exactly, right. In those days, you didn't have recorders, and people's verbal memories are far better than ours are today. So they often wrote them down after the sermon itself. And of course, the sermon on that day was an event because it was kind of the only show in town. There was no radio and no TV, and so people would flock to good preachers, and Eckhart was the greatest in his time. So people would hang on every word, and it was pretty easy for them to record what was said.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did they have babies and so on? Like, did they have families, or do you know that?
The Beguines? No, they did not. No, they were not married, did not have. You know, some of them were widows, mm-hmm. and they would have had children very likely beforehand, because widows were welcome to join. But as a group, no, they were celibate from that point of view.
And they went right into the Renaissance period, eh?
Well, they kind of did. They petered out. Of course, the Black Death wiped one third of Europeans out.
The who?
One third of Europeans were killed during the Black Death in the 14th century.
Of course.
So that made a big dent on everything. But we actually have some of the Beguinages. The places where they lived are kind of like museums now in Holland and Belgium, and you can visit them. They kind of went out of style. But also, remember, there were no what we'd call Catholic sisters today, or what they're called third order. They did not exist back then. If you were a sister or a nun, you were in the convent and expected to stay indoors, pretty much.
Be sequestered, sort of thing, huh?
Not be working out with the people, yeah.
Yeah, and these nuns were, the Beguines were activists, weren't they?
They were, exactly, and they were not technically nuns at all, and that's what disturbed the powers that be, that they were not easily controlled because they were not part of the system. They were a third thing. And it didn't fit into the structures that were operating at that time. So many of them were considered wanton women because they did travel, and they were outside cloisters, and they didn't take direct orders from popes and bishops. And the fact that the pope condemned them 17 times means that they weren't listening real hard to what he had to say.
So they were already unimpressed with that, weren't they?
They were unimpressed, put it that way. And also the Pope threatened Dominicans and Franciscan priests for working with them, saying that they would be excommunicated for working with these Beguines. But this did not slow Eckhart down. He did not back down at all. He kept working with the Beguines. And he learned a lot from them, clearly, because his language contains a lot of feminist images of the divine feminine. And also, we've now discovered that one of the Beguines who wrote books, named Marguerite Perret, she was burned at the stake in the early 14th century, in the 1300s in Paris. And actually, Eckhart, we have her book now that she wrote, and Eckhart quoted from that book quite frequently, even after she was burned at the stake. So that shows a lot of courage on Eckhart's part, that he was quoting from this so-called woman heretic even after she was burned at the stake.
Well, they all had to have a lot of courage to be standing up and speaking their spiritual truth, right? And so did
exactly. And that's why Eckhart's a warrior, and those women were warriors. Now, also Eckhart stood up for the peasants, because in his day, German was just the dialect of the peasants. It was not a full-fledged language. He was the first intellectual to preach in German and develop his ideas in German. And for that, he was criticized at his trial. We discovered the transcripts of his trial in the 19th century. And at his trial, they told him, "Why are you confusing the simple people, telling them in their language that they're other Christs, that they're sons and daughters of God, and even to be mothers of God," which is one of his teachings. We're all meant to be other Christs and birthers of Christ. "Why are you confusing these people preaching in their own language?" They said, "If you preach in Latin, we'd let you go." So Eckhart, he didn't say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I'll never do it again." He said, "The poor need to learn, for if they do not, they will not know how to live or why to die." And 10 years after he said that, the peasant wars broke out in Germany, and tens of thousands of peasants were killed in those wars. So Eckhart was very alert and aware that the gap between the haves and the have-nots was growing ever greater in his country at that time, and he spoke out to support the have-nots. So there are lessons there of warriorhood for our time as well.
Well, yeah, when you say it that way, I'm reminded at the very beginning, even just the intro, I was so beside myself with excitement because it made so much sense. But yeah, what you're saying is the word is from there is that it's very dangerous right now, and we really have to get conscious faster to make it change, right? This is not
exactly
a trifling time. And
exactly.
It's a perfect time for him, isn't it?
Exactly, yes, and this warrior energy. And so I end the book with two chapters on what I call the four E's, which I think are the most pressing issues of our time, including ecology, education, a new economics that serves everybody, not only every human on the planet, but all the forests and the waters and the fishes and the oceans and the soil too. And then, of course, ecumenism. And it's so clear in this book how ecumenical Eckhart is, how Sufis call him a Sufi, and Hindus call him a Hindu, and Buddhists call him a Buddhist. And
couldn't he be included in the atheists? Did I read that?
Well, yeah, he says, "I pray God to rid me of God." I think that's what atheists are talking about too. they're disappointed in the version of God that is often preached by those who say they believe. So we always have to be critiquing our notions of God. Eckhart says all the ideas of God we have come from an understanding of ourselves. So there's a great danger of projection when it comes to God talk.
Well, I think there's this whole thing about authority. It's kind of like the way he was writing it. At a certain time, I was thinking, and even a lot of them actually, is like dropping through the cat's cradle of political control or domination or whatever you want to call it, right?
That's right. Yeah, sure. Using religion to dominate and to control. And that's why religion so easily goes to bed with fascism, because fascism is a political construct of control. And bad religion and the idea of a punitive Father God feeds very much into those efforts to make an idol of control.
Well, it's funny because if we can be made afraid, we can be controlled, and that's kind of what's going on, isn't it?
That's true, exactly. Yeah, and love is the opposite of fear. So you get to choose. You're going to be a lover or you're going to be afraid. And once again, this is where that warrior energy comes in, that we have to stand up for what we believe. And love usually takes you to the edge and makes demands.
Of yourself, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if we really love the earth and future generations, our imaginations would be working overtime to reinvent the footprint that we're leaving on the earth. So the imagination would be there if we were in love nearly as much as we claim to be with future generations.
I thought it was really interesting talking about imagination, going back to what you already said, which is God is in the birth chamber or in the birth bed, right? Always in a state of creation. And I noticed all the way through that admiring imagination and admiring creation is, or really, really honoring that is a really important part of the evolution of our species, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's where I think education is failing so badly. I've been working for several years now with inner city kids, and my real question is, why are so many dropping out of school? 65% of black boys are not graduating from high school today in America. And the reason is that they're bored, and their creativity is not being tapped at all. Instead, they're being told they have to take exam upon exam upon exam, and that's boring. and it's not eliciting the wisdom and the energy and the creativity that's in these young people. So, you know, when there's a budget crunch in education, out goes the theater department and the music and the art. And
all the imagination stimulants.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the real crisis in education. And Eckhart has some real answers to that, because he really believes in intuition, the right brain, and mysticism is that kind of thing. And our system does not honor that. It does not respect it. Even Einstein talked about that. He said that we've been given two gifts, the sacred gift of intuition and the gift of rationality. But and rationality, he says, should serve intuition. But he said we live in a culture that honors rationality and has forgotten the sacred gift of intuition. And I think he's absolutely right. It's gotten worse since he said those words way back in the 50s. And I think that's why someone like Eckhart has so much to say today, because the mystic is swimming in intuition. And as Einstein says, values do not come from the intellect. He says values come from intuition and feeling, which he says are really the same thing. So this needs to be developed, and our educational systems are not doing a good job at that these days at all.
Because, again, the authority is money and control, isn't it?
Well, that's right, but it's also patriarchy. It's a left-brain bias, the idea that learning is about taking an exam instead of about blossoming and giving birth.
And you keep calling it wonder. Wonder is a great... I keep loving that. That's a wonder.
Yeah, that's so important to Eckhart, and so important to Rabbi Heschel. He says that wonder is, awe and wonder are the beginning of wisdom. So what we need is wisdom education, not just knowledge education.
But that requires the balancing of the male and female. The feminists are really coming up with a lot of aspects, right?
Exactly, exactly. And we've developed over the years, in my educational programs over 30 years, we've developed a pedagogy that honors both right and left brain, that honors both intuition and analysis. You can do both, and that's what a healthy school system should be. And we've had tremendous results in my master's and doctorate program, but now, as I say, we're also working with inner-city teenagers, high school kids.
What are you doing with them, Matthew?
We have a program called Yell Awe, and its purpose is precisely this, to go to the schools where there are heavy dropouts and to offer a model of education that emphasizes creativity over everything else. So we have kids making movies. We have them painting murals and, of course, poetry and music. And I remember one 18-year-old African-American kid said to me one day, he said, in 4 years of high school, he was a senior, this is the first time that anyone has asked me to express myself creatively.
Wow.
Imagine that.
Wow.
4 years of high school, and he had never been asked to create. And
are you seeing them kind of rise into themselves? Are you seeing them actually maybe not finish school but be retrained into something that gives them sense of
self? Well, we find them getting some confidence. And we took a survey of our kids at the end of the program, and 100% said they now understand school. And why? Because they experienced the joy of learning. And the joy of learning has a lot to do with creativity. It's a lot to do with discovering what's going on inside yourself and sharing it. And when you do that, these kids, any kid, will come alive.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean that they're able to sustain this after they left, or a couple of years after they left their program. Like one of them was an undergrad, you know, he's like a freshman when we had him, and he went on to another high school, and he didn't like it. He said the experience with us was so far superior that he was really critical of the high school that he went to.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's got to, what can I say, these kind of awakenings have to then be supported by other systems and other people, or they're just brief awakenings. They're not sustainable.
If you have Meister Eckhart's wisdom underlying or the underpinning of organized whatever, maybe that would be different, huh?
Yeah, well, again, I think what we have basically are knowledge factories, but not wisdom schools. And a wisdom school brings in the feminine, and it brings in the sense of awe and wonder, and of course, creativity. And there's so little room for that in the structures that we're calling it education right now.
But you've got some pretty feisty women in here that have profound wisdom. Are we women, are women making enough difference? Are we rising up enough, or are we still succumbing to that patriarchal limiting?
Well, it's true. Like in my chapter on education at the end, I have Lily Yeh, this wonderful Chinese artist who's worked in the inner city in Philadelphia and as well as in the inner city in China. And in Africa, worked with the very poor tribes in Africa, and she just does fabulous work. Again, it's all built around creativity. Then M.C. Richards, who comes out of the Rudolf Steiner tradition, she taught for years with me in my programs, and she's a clay. She does clay, and has students doing clay and poetry and so forth. And she was a marvelous teacher. But it's not just women. There are many men who have this relationship to the divine feminine and to creativity and to art, who are eager to teach as well. And it's very important that boys be exposed to men who are good teachers and not just to women. That's one of the problems we have today. You know, women are far outpacing men in attending college and graduating from college today. And while it's a great thing that many women are joining the professions and all this, at the same time, it's scary how many boys and men are falling behind. And part of it is that we are defining, when you define education as taking exams, as a rule, girls do better than boys because boys take longer to grow their brains, and also they learn more kinetically. They learn more with their bodies by falling off rocks and things. And you don't take exams around that stuff. You have to sit still to take an exam. And a lot of boys are being diagnosed as diseased, as having some kind of disease, just because they don't want to sit in a desk for 7 hours a day.
And drone, so the listening of the droning of the voices, yeah.
Well, exactly. And so it's not just about boys and girls. It's about getting a balance between masculine and feminine energies. And we can err in both directions if we don't approach this wisely.
But I think that also the rising of the feminine in the men as well. I think that has to happen, doesn't it? Like, what
yes.
do you think about?
Well, it does. But also, we need to clean up the masculine. See, we have a distorted teaching about the masculine that it's all about being number one. It's all about the reptilian brain, win lose. So I wrote a book a few years ago on the sacred masculine called The Hidden Spirituality of Men, 10 Metaphors to Awaken the Sacred Masculine. And it's about bringing back the balance. The last two chapters are about the marriage of the divine feminine and the sacred masculine, the sacred marriage. That's what we want. So it's wonderful that the divine feminine has come back and that women have banded together and done a lot of their inner work to bring back the divine feminine. Now, though, the men have to get more critical of what we're calling masculinity in our culture and get a healthier sense of the masculine and how it relates to the divine feminine as well.
Because it has to be nurturing, doesn't it? It has to be because of the nature of the way the world is right now.
Exactly. And the reptilian brain is triumphing still, and we have to make room for that mammal brain, which is the brain of compassion and intuition. And kinship, and also creativity.
That's really wonderful. Also, do you think that as a species, you know, the kind of layers and layers of what the human consciousness is and subconscious and all that, do you think it's rising, this rebalancing? Do you think it's rising in us in a massive level? Or do you think it's like its time has come?
Well, there certainly has been an awakening to the divine feminine in many quarters in my lifetime, the last 40 years or so, which is very positive. But it still has a long, long way to go, as we know. And many women around the world are still treated as third-class citizens and all the rest. And as I say, still our institutions, including education, are still wedded to a patriarchal consciousness that is dated and that is not cutting the mustard. It's not doing the job. And this is why many people are dropping out. And also why it's so expensive. When something is not really useful and doing its job, the price goes up.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting because even jobs, they'll say, well, there aren't any jobs. So why would somebody endure all that, you know?
Right, yeah.
That's really an important thing.
Yeah. So, and again, men have to become more critical and also more aware of their potential. One response to my book on the sacred masculine was from a Native American who told me he had been working in prisons for 12 years, and he said, mine was the first book that got men to look inside and find the nobility inside. He said, most men in prison project on others, and they don't want to look inside. Mm. And it's very hard to get them to do so. But the method in my book was to take 10 archetypes or metaphors of the sacred masculine, such as Father Sky or Green Man or Spiritual Warrior or Hunter-Gatherer or Fatherhood or Grandfatherhood, the Elder, and so forth. And so that's how the book is divided in those chapters. And he said these metaphors really got them looking inside and finding the nobility inside. I think that's a powerful, powerful phrase. And that's really key, I think, to men. Under patriarchy, men too have suffered because they've not found the nobility inside. They've been told to obey, to get in line, to go into the mines and into the factories and into war and
to kill
others,
yeah,
and kill. And so it's been an appeal to the reptilian brain. It's not been an appeal to the whole person of what a human being is, what a man can be. Now, one of the responses I got to the book, the very first one, was from a woman. She said, I have over 200 books on the goddess in my library at home, not a single book on the sacred masculine.
Wow.
And she said, I have two sons. She said, I didn't realize until I read your book how much men have suffered under patriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
I've been working for 40 years, she said, on my womanhood and recovering the divine feminine. I don't regret any of that. But she said, I agree with you. Now, the next step of feminism is we have to support the men to do more soul searching as well.
Mm-hmm. To realize that they can create.
Exactly.
Wow, because they are very strong and wise. Tell me about creation spirituality. What is that? That's part of your baby, right?
Well, yeah, it's the alternative tradition within Christianity. It's been an unwanted stepson for centuries, but it doesn't begin with original sin, which is not only bad news and pessimistic, but is also anthropocentric. It begins with creation itself and with original blessing. And of course, this one of my
I like that books, original blessing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm glad you like it. The Pope didn't. That really got the Pope riled up.
Well, that's a little bit of good publicity right there.
That's true. That gave it some good publicity.
Yeah.
But they have some people in the Vatican have a real investment in original sin, even though Jesus never heard of it. No Jews ever heard of original sin, and Jesus did not preach original sin. So it's a distortion of the tradition, and yet it's running still of most of the Christian churches, and. So anyway, this tradition is feminist because the wisdom of Israel from which it comes, wisdom is feminine in the Bible. Chokmah in Hebrew and Sophia in Greek are feminine. And she's feminine around the world. And she's also all about the sacredness of creation, the revelation, in fact, that nature is. And so like Thomas Aquinas, 13th century, who is in this tradition, he says that Revelation comes in two volumes, nature and the Bible. But if we say Revelation is only in the Bible, we leave out all of nature, and it also means that we're anti-scientific because scientists are the ones who teach us about nature. So therefore they're teaching us about the revelation that nature is if we listen carefully instead of fight them all the time. And of course, Hildegard of Bingen, the great 12th century mystic and reformer and musician and genius, she was very creation-centered too. And of course, Meister Eckhart is a real champion in this regard. Eckhart says, every creature is a source of revelation and a book about God. So he's saying every single creature is a Bible. He says, if I spend enough time with a caterpillar, I'd never have to prepare a sermon because one caterpillar is so full of God. So he too comes from this wisdom tradition and from the creation spiritual tradition of the Bible.
So I wonder, you know, as we're speaking of this, I wonder about if we had grown up with the awareness that God is in every blade of grass, you know, that kind of creation. I wonder if we wouldn't have treated our planet a lot better at this time.
Absolutely, absolutely, no. One reason there is an ecological crisis is that people like Augustine, who are dualistic, separated nature from grace and said all nature is fallen and all the rest, and he set science back. He said, you know, in effect, he was saying we don't have to learn from science because somehow a belief alone is enough. And one Nobel-winning scientist, a chemist, said that Augustine set science back 1,000 years by that kind of teaching. Aquinas broke with Augustine, and Augustine was following Plato, whereas Aquinas followed Aristotle, and he said, I prefer Aristotle to Plato because Aristotle does not denigrate matter. Mm. So this, and that's a very feminist perspective, you see, that matter is not something negative.
Something to push
spirit
against,
and matter go
right?
together.
Yeah.
What's that?
Something to push against, it seems like.
Yeah.
So that's...
And a scapegoat, we make a scapegoat out of matter.
Yeah.
But,
so you've got, here we've got all these different, all the different religions. And, I mean, you've done a lot of research, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of study.
And that's what's so uncanny about Eckhart. He's so unique, but that I don't know anyone else ever about whom a Sufi would say Eckhart is a Sufi, a Christian could say he's a Christian, a Buddhist says he's Buddhist, Hindus say he's Hindu, and he also has long common black elk and indigenous traditions. He's unique, and that's why I think we're in a unique position today to be appreciative of him and to be nurtured by him. And I think that's why he speaks so deeply to people today, including yourself. And the fact that he brings in the divine feminine in a very, very strong and very balanced way.
So did he use ritual? I was watching some of your videos as well, and you were talking about doing rituals and ceremonies.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, for example, for young boys, there's very little ritualizing your manhood sort of thing. You know, did he participate in that?
Well, of course, in his day, you had the Mass and the sacraments. You had confirmation and so forth. But today, of course, we have many new languages, so I'm very involved in trying to renew worship in what we call the Cosmic Mass. We just did one 2 weeks ago at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco for about 800 people. Mm. And what we're doing is we're bringing in the new languages of DJing and VJing and rap and dance. And, of course, dance is not new. Dance is a very old way to pray, but it seems new because in the modern era, people were not invited to dance in church. And to bring their bodies to church, we were busy turning pages and reading texts and having texts read to us. And
keeping your body under total control, right?
Exactly. So we've been doing these cosmic masses now since I became an Episcopal priest 16 years ago. And we've done over 97 of them now. And we're very excited about the results. Not just young people, but young and old together derive so much benefit from healthy ceremony and healthy ritual. Meledumasome, the African spiritual teacher, says there is no community without ritual. So having strong ritual is very important, and we have these new ways to pray today. Many of them come from the rave movement.
You mentioned that. Why is that? I don't know much about it.
Well, a rave is an all-night celebration that young people go to, and it's about having a trance. It's about going into a trance. And really, that's what ritual should do for you. It should take you to another place. Now, unfortunately, a lot of rave today has succumbed to the drug thing, but it wasn't that way when it began, and it's not that way, certainly, when we employ some of their methods into our worship. There's no drug allowed, but things happen, profound things. For example, in response to our mass the other day at Grace Cathedral, a woman came up to me and she said, I'm from Ontario, Canada, and she said, we've just closed down the Anglican Cathedral there. It's 150 years old and a very beautiful building, but there were no one there except old people. She said they couldn't sustain it. But here, she said, at this event, you have people of all ages mixing and singing and dancing, and there's real life here where there was complete death back there at our cathedral in Canada. So a lot of people are looking for ritual today. This is why Burning Man, 60,000 people go out in the summer to the desert for a ritual called Burning Man. Why do they do that? Because ritual is part of the human condition. We need it for community. We need it for healing. We need it for celebration, for creativity, for joy.
Well, tell me, what kind of music do you use in the Cosmic Mass? Do you use...
Well, we use DJs.
Okay.
We use DJs, electronic music a lot. But we also have live music as well. We have sometimes drums and sometimes people singing with a hand drum, kind of shamanistically. One of our recent masses, we had a group of native singers singing indigenous songs at the beginning and at the end with a big drum. We even had a piano at our mass at Grace Cathedral, but we also had the DJ doing electronic music. So we combine, ours are times of mixing, and so we combine different forms of music and chanting and singers leading us in chant. At our Grace Cathedral Mass, this wonderful folk singer Jennifer Barrett sang led us in several songs, and she also did the teaching for us. So yeah, we do a great variety of music.
Wow, this is such great news.
The actual dance is electronic dance with the DJ. We do that twice for about 18 minutes each time.
And do you see people going into big trances themselves?
we get that
kind of
feedback.
Seeing
for example,
and so on.
Well, we have a grief part in every one of our cosmos. We do grieving, and instead of a confession of sins, we do grieving, and we have a practice that we help people to grieve. We get down on all fours and so on, and this is very powerful. And after the last mass, I'd say at least 8 people came up to me, most of them women. One of them was a Native American woman, thanking me just for the grief part alone. They said it was so important and so powerful. One woman told me that her husband had died several months ago, and that this was finally, she felt a breakthrough in her grieving process and so forth. Being able to grieve with others is something she said I've never really done before. So grief is a very important issue today. We're not going to release our creativity, which is our only hope of salvation as a species. We're not going to release creativity if we can't grieve, because when your grief is, you're stuck in grief, and everyone's grieving today, but they don't know what to do about it. The churches are not helping, and not everyone can talk to a therapist. And besides, talking is not the best way to deal with grief anyway.
No.
It's
literally gut-wrenching, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You have to unleash this bottleneck in our third chakras, which is, as you say, the gut.
Yeah, right. It's amazing.
So we do that.
Yeah, because one of the things I read, and I think it was with Adrienne Rich, but she was talking about grief as being, she didn't put it this way, but like a portal into your deeper spiritual being, right?
Yes. She addresses grief too, definitely.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm really glad you're doing that. Well, I think we're almost drawing to a close. Where are you? You're in San Francisco area, and you're doing, you're at Grace Cathedral most of the time, are you?
No. I'm not there very often, but I live in Oakland,
mm-hmm.
and which is across the bay from San Francisco. And people could go online, MatthewFoss.org, and see where I'm speaking. But I speak in many places. I'm on my way to Korea this weekend and Australia. The Koreans have translated about half a dozen of my books.
Wonderful.
And I've never lectured there before. But people can find out where I'm at by going to my webpage, and there's a pretty updated schedule there. Also, our next Cosmic Masses. The next one we know we're doing for sure will be in October here in the East Bay.
Will you be doing some in Korea as well and in Australia?
No.
Okay.
No. I won't be doing the Cosmic Masters. I'll be lecturing.
You'll
Korea.
Be lecturing.
Yeah.
And you also give classes sometimes, for creation?
Well. Yes, that's true. And we're talking about starting up our Doctor Ministry program again very soon. So people should stay tuned. Again, go to the webpage, MatthewFoss.org. And they can find out what's cooking.
Well, I am so grateful that you had time for us today, and bless you for all you're teaching us. And I'm going to get into more Meister Eckhart books, although this one by you is it's really rich. And the people that you're bringing together with Meister Eckhart are all worthy of studying as well. I mean, they just open you like a book.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, Veronica, and I encourage you, and thank you for your having your radio program. It's a great thing to be able to talk about these mysteries at this time in history. It's so important that we open ourselves up to some of the wise figures like Eckhart and become mystic warriors ourselves.
Yeah, because it occurred to me that these emanations of wisdom that come from them frequency-wise are really penetrating our culture. Now. Does that make sense?
I hope so.
We need it.
We well, need all the help we can get.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on to Paradigm Shifters. Many, many blessings
on
your trip.
Thank you. Bye now.
Goodbye.